Good morning. This is from Zero Hedge yesterday. Russia is done with the West. The divorce is nearly complete. Quoting from this article, we'll just take a few little spots. Russia is done with the West. The divorce is nearly complete. In the past few days, we've heard from all major Russian leaders the same thing. And I quote, "The West will play by our rules now." End of quote. Continuing with the article. You can decide for yourselves whether Russia is writing checks they can't cash. But in the words of Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, telling the BBC bluntly, and I quote again, "We do not care about the eyes of the West." End of quote. Lavrov has always been the soul of politeness and discretion in dealing with European media. His open hostility towards his BBC interviewer was not only palpable, it was hard to argue with. He followed that up with, and I quote again, "I don't think there's even room for maneuver left anymore." Because both Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Foreign Secretary Liz Truss of the UK say publicly, "We must defeat Russia. We must bring Russia to its knees." Go on then. Do it. Basically saying, I dare you. And another interesting thing, and we haven't gonna really draw from it, but there is a very deep rivalry between the UK and Russia. And the UK has probably been by far the most outspoken against Russia and the whole Ukrainian mess. Continuing with the article, though, Russia's leadership never talks in such openly blunt terms. Russia knows it has the West on the ropes. We need what they produce, and now they are determined to set the rules on who gets them and for what price. It knows that European leaders are puppets with Klaus Schwab. We'll talk a little bit about Klaus Schwab in just a little bit. I think he's a passing figure on the scene, but he's creating a lot of trouble right now. And it knows Davos. Davos is the kind of the central area for the World Economic Forum. And it knows Davos has zero leverage over Russia's actions from here on out. And this goes on to what we were talking about with the financial systems, which brings me to the statements linked above by Gazprom CEO Alexei Miller. Speaking at a panel at the St. Petersburg Economic Investment Forum, he just put the situation in the starkest terms there is. He said, and I quote, "The game of nominal value of money is over." Nominal value or fiat currency that we were talking about. The American system. "The game of nominal value of money is over, as this system does not allow to control the supply of resources. Our product, our rules. We don't play by the rules we didn't create." Miller's statement should be thought of as a statement of principle across all theaters of operation for Russia. This doesn't just apply to natural gas or oil. This is everything. All of Russia's dealings with the West from here on out will be on its terms, not the West. And going on a little further here, it goes on to state, "Let's hope the noises coming from the West about the sanctions having gone too far and the chest beating of the worst U.S. and British neocons or neoconservatives is no longer being taken seriously by anyone with their fingers anywhere near the launch codes. If that's the case, then these new rules will be grudgingly accepted only after a lot of borders have been redrawn, new alliances formed, and different world order established." And that's what we were trying to get at yesterday. There is a new world order. "This morning at the President Putin declared, the old world order is dead. He finished his speech where he detailed how the West was committing suicide to suit the wishes of the Davos crowd." Again, the World Economic Forum. "With the following definitive statement," this is out of the mouth of Putin, Russia is entering the coming era as a powerful sovereign country. We will definitely use the enormous new opportunities that time opens up for us. We will become even stronger. End of quote. The analysis here says Putin is correct. And we know, as believers, Putin is correct. Russia is getting stronger by the day. The West took their best shot at destroying Russia and missed the mark. He clearly identified the real culprits for Europe's and the U.S.'s problems. Subservience to an oligarch class who feel entitled to rule the world. When the war started, But he says, today, in fact, when Putin made his move on Ukraine, the ultimate goal was the end of Russia treating the West as an equal and leading the global South out of what he has called vassalage. The reason Putin is hated is because he realizes there are two types of countries, sovereigns and vassals. It's been his life's work to make Russia into a sovereign state free from the West. From Russia's perspective, their military operation in Ukraine was their declaration of independence from the old rules-based order of the post-World War II era. Justified or not, we are now in a new age. The question is now, how many will survive into it? And that's the end of the article. I think he does a pretty good job of making sense of where things are as we speak. Again, we look at trends, not necessarily the latest headline, but we look at trends. Now, where we left it yesterday is that for the time being, we see tensions that appear more east and west in nature. There has been the facade of NATO unity against Russia, and it's only a facade. But please understand that the majority of NATO nations will fall under Russian influence. Based upon our understanding of prophecy, the majority of NATO nations will fall under Russian influence, most notably Germany and France. I think I have a map of where NATO currently stands. It's quite a big block. And it should be understandable to us as to why Russia sees this as a threat. It's something that has to be neutralized. The alliances as they now stand, this NATO alliance, will not hold. It will not hold. No matter what they're saying, no matter what little clippets in the news we see, the NATO alliance will not hold. And we see the shifting taking place even now. We are, in fact, seeing NATO push at, to use a biblical terminology out of Daniel 11, we are seeing NATO push at Russia through territorial encroachment and the arming of Ukraine. But the stage is not yet set for the Russian Confederacy to move south as described by the prophets. We have to be very careful and very patient in how we view these things. But we are seeing that things can change fast. Things move very slowly until they don't anymore. Something will have to change that involves Russia asserting dominance over all of continental Europe, either by economic and or military coercion. This will include, and I think we can take this to the bank, this will include the collapse of NATO and a smaller alignment of exclusively Tarshish nations. The U.S., Britain, and Australia have already formed what is called AUKUS, A-U-K-U-S, which is a trilateral security partnership, and for the time being to counter Chinese expansionism in the Pacific. But we see, again, birds of a feather flock together, and so we're seeing that come together. NATO is a dying alliance, and Germany and France will soon see that their interests are aligned with Russia. Germany and France will soon see that their interests are aligned with Russia. Now, the headlines in the news at this time do not bear that out. But again, looking through the prophetic lens, we know that that's where things are going to end up. We must realize that Christ returned to resurrect the dead and gather the living saints for judgment requires no preconditions. We're not looking for preconditions for Christ's return. Much of our end-time expectations will not fully be manifest until the saints have been gathered to judgment. We must always keep in mind that Christ can return at any time. Christ can return at any time. Now, before talking about Israel, we wish to talk briefly about what is called the Great Reset and its impact on current conditions. This is what Putin and the Russians reference to when they talk about Davos. They're no fans of globalization on the West terms. You all have probably heard of this individual up here, Klaus Schwab. And if you haven't, you need to familiarize yourselves with him. He is the founder and head of the World Economic Forum, an international group based out of Switzerland. It hosts a yearly conference in Davos, Switzerland, inviting the elite of the world composed of business leaders, political leaders, economists, celebrities, and journalists. It is an advocate for globalist, socialistic, political, and economic agendas. All the conspiracy theories that you have heard over the years regarding a one-world government, well, they are true and find concentration in this group. The phrase that maybe you've heard this, maybe you haven't, the phrase that by 2030 you will own nothing and you will be happy is from a propaganda video put out by this group that has the desire for the realignment and reorganization of the world economies under one centralized authority. This is essentially communism revived on steroids. They view that they have the answer, the intellectual ability, the influence and power to solve all the world's problems. All you have to do is go to the website. They're not ashamed of what they think. Their agenda, and I quote, includes global governance, internet governance, human rights, LGBTQ inclusion, gender parity, etc. A very liberal agenda. They also push the idea of ESG, which is the economic social governance standard that we, whether you realize it or not, you are living under now. And it actually explains a lot of what we're seeing in society that seems to be going along with all this social change. The economic social governance standard that many of us are now and soon going to be answering to and is already in full implementation in the financial sector. You can look up many corporation websites and they all talk about their compliance with ESG. That's why you'll see them pushing why we have State Farm Insurance. Why is State Farm Insurance pushing transgenderism? That's because of ESG. Many Western nations are all in on this, which is a big reason that we are seeing the social and governing insanity that we are experiencing right now. Leaders such as Trudeau in Canada and much of his cabinet, as well as Governor Newsom of California, were graduates of Schwab's young leadership efforts. The WEF, the World Economic Forum, views the United States people as the biggest threat to them reaching their utopian dreams. Now, we only mention this as it is making a mess of things right now. And we believe it to be a fleeting issue, but it is making a mess. And it is very frog-like in its expressed sentiments of liberty, fraternity, and equality. Though there certainly is not much about this that is liberating or equal. As believers, we should understand that one world governance during the time of the Gentiles will not come to fruition. There will be no single global authority this side of the kingdom. But there will be two major competing interests that characterize the time of the end. But we see this frog-like spirit of fermentation, godlessness, immorality, and chaos, not world order, equity, or peace, that is wreaking havoc on the political and social orders of our time, and greatly weakening the U.S., as current leadership in many Western nations, including the U.S., is all in on this. And it is this deterioration and corruption that is making the way for Russia to be able to make the moves that it is making. Now, speaking of godlessness, and interestingly enough, the Catholic system is all in on this as well. It's really, should be no surprise. The Catholic Church is involved with the WEF. But it also has its own initiative known as the Council for Inclusive Capitalism with the Vatican. You can go to its website. Now, this isn't getting much attention in the media, but its goals are parallel with the WEF, but puts the Catholic Church in the driver's seat of influence. And these clippets that we have here are taken off the website itself. This effort is headed up by the Vatican and involves a partnership with 27 core leaders from corporations from around the world. Many, many corporations that you will fully recognize. These corporations involve some 200 million employees in 163 nations with 2.1 trillion in market capitalization. These business leaders meet with the Pope annually to receive guidance on how to reform capitalism to the liking of the Catholic Church. The Pope stated that it was to develop, and I quote, an economic system that is fair, trustworthy, and capable of addressing the most profound challenges facing humanity and our planet is urgently needed, end of quote. The stated goal by the Vatican is to, and I quote again, to build a fairer, more inclusive, and sustainable economic foundation for the world. End of quote. And we have to ask the question is, fairer and more inclusive, who? How much money does the Catholic Church sit on? We don't know. They won't tell anybody. I mean, the estimates are in the billions, if not the trillions of dollars of money that they have, whether in assets or in actual cash. Don't see them too willing to share that. It should be clear to us that the Vatican, the false prophet, sees an opportunity at reasserting influence. The Vatican doesn't care about Christian values. The Vatican does not care about Christian values as they continue to liberalize the church to stay in sync with modern social values. They're more concerned about keeping members in their seats and keeping that money flowing in than they are about standing for principle. And we see a battle taking place within the Catholic Church right now between more conservative elements and the more liberalized elements that are headed up by the current Pope. The Church is a business. Make no mistake about it. It has always been a business. And the Vatican wants its fingers in everything, especially when money and power are involved. Spiritual influence is simply a convenient and manipulative tool in their hands. How do we know this? Let's look at Revelation 17, 1 and 2. We're not just being mean to the Catholic Church. Revelation 17, 1 and 2. Speaking of the harlot system. Come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters. With him the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. And looking at Revelation 18, 11 through 15. Speaking of the time when Babylon the Great, this mystic Babylon, which was referenced in our reading in Isaiah yesterday, is brought to her final end. It says, and the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buyeth their merchandise anymore. And the Vatican system is very much involved with the economics of this world. The merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and of pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and all fine wood and all manner of vessels of ivory and all manner of vessels of most precious wood, brass and iron, marble and cinnamon, odors, ointments, frankincense, and wine and oil, and fine flour, and wheat, and beasts, and sheep, and horses, and chariots, and slaves, and souls of men. And to stop for just a moment, we watched a PBS documentary several years ago. In the introductory comments of this documentary of what it was about the Vatican, in the very first 1 minute of the documentary, they talked about how the Catholic Church dealt in souls of men. Dealt in souls of men. I don't think that they were thinking in scriptural terms, but. And going on, and the fruits that thy soul lusted after are departed from thee, and all things which were dainty and goodly are departed from thee, and thou shalt find them no more at all. The merchants of these things which were made rich by her shall stand afar off with the fear of her torment, her weeping and wailing. So it makes perfect sense that the Catholic Church has its fingers on the economic movements of this earth. Now the Catholic Church is attempting to revive the glory days that enjoyed at the height of the Holy Roman Empire, as described in Revelation 13. They are doing such as one of the primary voices of the humanistic frog-like spirits. According to their website, and they wish to create, and we have them listed up here, they use that word equality a lot. Equality of opportunity. Equitable outcomes, fairness across generations on the environment, fairness to all enabling full economic participation. These are the frog-like spirits. Again, it speaks of fairness, it speaks of equity, and there's nothing equitable about any of it. This is a guise, this is a false mask to hide behind to increase their own power and influence. Again, are these principles not in harmony with the spirit set in motion by the French Revolution? When we talk about things that have happened in our past that still have major impacts, French Revolution, which we could spend a week on the French Revolution alone, we are still feeling the impact of that. Men's cries of equality and humanistic ideals only result in greater inequalities, chaos, and oppression. And just to use a current example, if we see that this Roe versus Wade issue is actually overturned, I think we're talking about it being released possibly on Friday. Now, they thought it would be Wednesday, but they keep putting it off. If this is overturned, again, what is the cry that people keep crying? My choice, my body, my choice. And if this is overturned, we're going to probably see violence that is makes the events of George Floyd's death seem like small potatoes. Again, it's just this fermentation. How far will the WEF be allowed to go in implementing their ambitions is hard to say. But it certainly is a current force for evil. What we can expect is that the Catholic Church will carry this spirit forward, as well as Europe and eventually, to a great degree, the dragon or the Russian bear, which will no doubt use these influences for its own advantage. Now, in talking about Israel, Israel is to be the very center of our worldview. We should understand that. Reading from Isaiah 43, verses 10 through 13. Isaiah 43, verses 10 through 13. Ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, and my servant whom I have chosen, that ye may know and believe me, and understand that I am he. Before me there was no God, or ale, or power, form, neither shall there be after me. I, even I am Yahweh, and beside me there is no Savior. I have declared, and I have saved. I have showed when there was no strange God among you. Therefore ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, that I am God or El. Yea, before the day was I am He, and there is none that can deliver out of my hand. I will work, and who shall let it, or avert it? And I type these verses into my iPad here, and the spell check wreaks havoc on the old English, so I apologize sometimes when I trip over some of these words. The evangelical world has placed a great deal of emphasis on Israel as well. Again, I mentioned the Christian Broadcasting Network, the Trinity Broadcasting Network, and they've really made it their mission to draw focus or attention to Israel. That's all fine. But beware of their efforts, as seen in news and information, Christian information services, shows, and documentaries. They turn Israel into somewhat of a sensational witness to their own work and efforts. And it is not rooted in an understanding of the hope of Israel and the ultimate realization of the Abrahamic promises. And we are seeing among evangelical ranks that there are major shifts that continue to follow the rest of the world in rising anti-Semitism. Now, speaking to that for just a moment, we refer to a recent article from Arut Sheva, that's Israel's National News, that outlines these statistics that we have up here. Now, according to the Center for the Study of contemporary European Jewry, hatred of Jews is on a significant rise, and this is according to their 2021 survey. And this is out of an article that states, "How do I hate thee, Israel? Let me count thy ways." This was within the last 2 or 3 weeks. In the U.S. itself, which has the largest Jewish population outside of Israel, the number of anti-Jewish hate crimes reported in both New York and Los Angeles was almost twice that the previous year. In France, the number of reported anti-Semitic incidents increased by nearly 75% compared with 2020. In Canada, a leading Jewish group reported a 40-year record in anti-Semitic physical violence in 1 month, in August. In the UK, the number of recorded physical assaults against Jews increased by 78% compared with 2020. In Germany, anti-Semitic incidents reported by police were up 29% compared with 2020. In Australia, there was the sharpest rise in reported anti-Semitic incidents, with 88 in May alone, this past May. In Ukraine, the Jewish population is around 43,000. Acts of vandalism against Jews increased 162.5% in 2019. In fact, according to the annual report on hate crimes released by the Uniform Crime Reporting Program of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, it is Jews among the world's tiniest populations, 15 million, a world of nearly 8 billion, who experience the most bias, hatred, assaults, blatant racism, and hate crimes. 15 million Jews in the world. Again, that should be of no surprise to us. And if the Jews think that they're safe in the United States, I think they're, over the coming times, I think they're going to be sadly mistaken. I don't know that the United States is going to be quite the safe haven that they have always put their stock in. And just as the Jews were, World War II helped to facilitate, to push the Jews back to the land, we know that there's also another, after Christ returned, there's also another regathering of Ephraim throughout the nations. And so I would think or suspect that the Jews will want, for some reason or another, will want to get out of where they are. we will see. We have also seen a remarkable turnaround here in the U.S. towards Israel over the past couple of years. Actually, the entire West has gone mad, along with their handling of COVID, their transgender obsessions, to their own economies. It is clear that anti-Semitism is being stoked as well. The leftist ideology is very anti-Israel. Leftist ideology is very anti-Israel. A lot of times people talk about the far right, and there are certainly pockets of that. But it is the leftist ideology that is running rampant with anti-Semitism, and always has. It is very anti-Jewish in its thinking, and this even includes many Jews themselves. There are several Jews that are on the Biden administration, but their views and policies certainly to be in line with leftist thinking. A couple of reasons are given to this, and we're going to refer. This is also out of a Roots. That happens to be just some headlines regarding the Biden administration that have appeared. Biden is no friend of Israel. That was the headline. Biden to visit Jerusalem to tell the world that Zion belongs to Muslims. Biden's State Department strongly opposes new Jewish homes in Israel. The Biden Institute's rules forbidding U.S. soldiers from non-official travel to Israel. Why is the Biden administration determined to help terrorists, Iran, get a bomb? And we see this unfolding constantly. I don't really know how much it's Biden himself. It seems to be more of those pulling the strings behind the scenes, really. Don't know that he's that capable. This is the reasons for, and I've always wondered about this, why the Jews, at least especially American Jews, seem to always be willing to shoot themselves in the foot. One comment was the late English journalist Malcolm Muggeridge Matthews writes, said, "I am not certain that college attendance is the only cause of Jewish liberalism, but it is probably the most likely culprit. Many colleges are festering pustules of regressive socialist Marxist thinking. Our Jewish youngsters are being groomed intellectually to be perversely liberal." And another comment here, an editor, writer, and conservative political commentator, Norman Podhoretz, has posited that to most American Jews, liberalism is the very essence of being a Jew. It is a religion in its own right, complete with its own catechism and its own dogmas, and Tertullian-like, obdurately resistant to facts. Obdurately resistant to facts. It's just a few thoughts. And I know there's connection with a loyalty to more liberal causes due to Truman establishing the state, helping to establish the state of Israel, but it's a much different political system than it was at that time. Now, interestingly enough, while the West descends into Israel or Jew hatred, Israel has made great strides in reconciling with their once enemies in the Arab world. This is probably one of the most exciting and interesting developments since Egypt made peace with Israel in 1979. Its prophetic importance is quite significant. On September 15, 2020, Foreign Affairs Minister of Bahrain, Abdulatif bin Rashid al-Zayani, Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, U.S. President Donald Trump, and Foreign Affairs Minister of the United Arab Emirates, Abdullah bin Zayed al-Nahyan, attending the signing of the Abraham Accords at the White House. This has been a couple of years. Bahrain was also added to this agreement, and other Arab world nations have also shown moves in joining. This appeared to come out of nowhere, but it was a product of the Trump and Netanyahu's administration efforts to bypass conventional approaches to Middle East peace, as previous efforts have always focused on a settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. With the establishment of the Palestinian state, they bypassed all that. The effort seized upon the weariness over the Palestinian issue by many of the Arab Gulf states, as well as critical concerns over the growing Iranian threat in the Middle East. There had already been unofficial and secretive military cooperation between Israel and various Arab countries for several years to counter Iranian aggression. It just wasn't made public. The Abraham Accords are not officially a peace agreement, as there has been no previous state of war. What is agreed upon is that Israel would temporarily refrain from annexing the West Bank in exchange for official recognition, opening up the exchange of embassies between Israel and its partner countries. The agreement includes bilateral agreements regarding investment, tourism, direct flights, security, telecommunications, technology, energy, healthcare, culture, the environment, and other areas of mutual benefit. A joint statement regarding the accords added that opening direct lines between the two Middle East most dynamic societies and advanced economies will transform the region by spurring economic growth, enhancing technological innovation, and forging closer people-to-people relations. It's interesting that when the present U.S. administration came into power, that they did a lot to try to trip this up and create problems between Israel and its new Arab friends, of which they have not been able to do. They have failed. So the Abraham Accords are standing strong. Let it be understood that this agreement is not about some kind of newfound love between Israel and its Arab neighbors. It is a relationship of perceived necessity. As the specter of a nuclear Iran nears reality, and as U.S. influence and power is changing focus as well as faltering, the Arab countries need the military and economic expertise and cooperation that Israel and only Israel can provide, as well as the most sophisticated weaponry that the U.S. has to offer if they can get it. And it looks like that window is closed, unless in the most recent effort to beg Saudi Arabia for oil for the United States, they come up with some kind of military arms agreement. Almost immediately, the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, was promised F-35 fighter jets from the U.S. That was under Trump, which they should not have received without signing the accord. Since the original signing, Sudan and Morocco have also entered into agreements with Israel, with the promise of more countries to come, including Saudi Arabia. We are reminded of the old saying that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And Iran is not only the enemy of Israel, but as a radical Shiite-ruled country, it is the enemy of its Sunni Muslim neighbors in the south. The prospect of peace and trade that the Abraham Accords bring are not our primary concern, though. It is the prophetic implications of the agreement that are of the greatest interest as we see the various pieces of the end-time prophetic picture fall into place. Bible prophecy indicates that along with the merchants or traders of Tarshish, the objections against Gogian aggression against Israel as declared in Ezekiel 38:13 will include Sheba and Dedan. These ancient names point to general territories more associated with the southern areas of the Arabian Peninsula, which would include Bahrain, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and even Yemen. Both Bahrain and the UAE have booming economies based on oil and financial services. Bahrain, a former protectorate of the British Empire, was declared in 2008 as the fastest growing financial center in the world. The UAE is one of the most wealthy countries in the world and is a close second behind Saudi Arabia in the region. The UAE was also once a British protectorate, and both Bahrain and the UAE have close financial and political ties with the United States and Britain. Like the US and Britain, such are merchant or trading nations, on a global scale and are doing all that they can to protect their interests. It comes down to money. So, prophetically speaking, instead of being mortal enemies against Israel, we are seeing Arab states align themselves with Israel and the interest of the Tarshish trading nations. Again, this isn't about holding hands around the campfire with a newfound love, but about the security of national sovereignty and financial interest in the growing Iranian threat, as well as growing Russian influence in the region. When the Gogian Confederacy overruns Egypt and Israel, the Arab nations will not be in alliance against Israel. The Arab nations will not be in alliance against Israel, as certain elements of Christadelphy have been adamantly preaching for some time. The Arab nations will not be in alliance against Israel, but will be in alliance with the Tarshish powers. How do we know this? Not by current events. We know it because the scriptures tell us. They will, in fact, protest the invasion. Once Egypt, as Daniel 11 tells us, and Israel have been overrun, do you think Saudi Arabia, UAE, will be sitting there glad and happy? No, they're going to know they're next on the menu. It won't come to that, but they know that they'll be next if nothing is done to intervene. Now, Sheba and Dedan, along with the merchants of Tarshish, will see this as a crisis of the greatest magnitude that is as much a threat to themselves and the world as it will be a crisis in relation to Israel. They will understand that this will be as much of a threat to themselves and the world as it would be a crisis in relation to Israel. This truly will be a crisis like no other the world has ever experienced. Over the last few decades, there has been a school of thought among Christadelphians that the Arabs or Israel's neighbors in the region were the primary threat to Israel, not a Russian confederacy, and would come up against Israel in the end times, prompting the return of Christ to come to Israel's aid. Such has never been a viable prophetic viewpoint. Egypt made peace with Israel in 1979, later followed by Jordan. Now there is a domino effect as the regional neighbors of Israel see the benefits of an alliance with Israel. Enemies of Israel still remain, namely Iran and Syria, who continue to fight a proxy war against Israel through terrorist surrogates. But the idea of a united Arab front against Israel, as existed in 1948, 67, and 73, cannot be expected from a prophetic standpoint. When Sheba, Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish see Egypt and Israel fall at the hands of the Gogian Confederacy, which included in the Gogian Confederacy is Iran, or as listed there, Persia in Ezekiel 38:5. And no doubt Syria as well, they will understand that a power grab for Middle Eastern control, namely oil and natural gas as the target, will be a threat to themselves and the world. But we also, and this, we hate to make this a side note, because there's a lot more to be said on this, but we also know that this end-time invasion will not only be an economic issue of oil, natural gas, riches, but it'll also be religious in nature. Again, Russia views itself as the defender of Orthodox Christianity. They have their eyes, they have their sights set on the holy places that are in Jerusalem. And as a matter of fact, there is currently a fight with Israel and Russia over some a certain portion of land that Russia wants to be declared as their sovereign property. So there is a religious element in this. Quite strongly. that's as it should be. Especially as we introduce Christ and the saints into the mix. Now, Israel in the present crisis itself, Israel finds itself in an extremely difficult position, as it has tried to walk a fine line between preserving good relations with both Ukraine and Russia during this conflict. Israel has received heavy criticism from both sides, who claim they have not received the support from Israel they deserve. Ukraine, which, matter of fact, is, whether you realize it or not, is a protector of Nazi elements. There are powerful Nazi elements that are still, now we're not talking about neo-Nazis, this is actual holdovers from World War II. A very strong cultural Nazi element there in Ukraine, which is kind of ironic considering they have a Jewish president or prime minister. Ukraine has demanded more military aid from Israel. In contrast, Russia was angered by Israel's condemnation of their military invasion. And since then, Russia has denied Israel's claim upon the Golan Heights, as well as no longer turning a blind eye to Israel's military strikes within Syria. At the same time, Israel has angered Washington, which appears to only be looking for excuses to condemn Israel. The reason? The United States wants Israel to supply armaments to Ukraine. For Israel, this has been a no-win situation. They're not making Ukraine happy, they're not making Russia happy, and they're not making the United States happy. Which really is what we would expect, isn't it? Now, with the signing of this energy agreement by Israel in Egypt with Europe, they made mention to this a couple of days ago, maybe yesterday, I can't remember, but both Israel and Egypt find themselves in the crosshairs of the Russian bear. Please let it be noted that when Russia and its confederacy makes its grand move into the Middle East and Israel, that Egypt will also fall victim in the attack. Daniel 11:41. He, the king of the north, shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab, or present-day Jordan, and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, as the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps, or in league with, or under the authority of Russia, and helping in this effort. So this deal with Israel and Europe, and Russia has already expressed its great displeasure with this, and the fact that it does put Israel in the position of being an enemy. We're not going to read from this article, but probably a lot of you have already seen this, and if you haven't, you can easily look that up and read some of the details of this oil deal. But what's going to happen is Israel is going to pipeline their natural gas into Egypt. Of course, Egypt has its own natural gas fields as well. They're going to, I can't remember the process, that you change that gas into fluid, and they're going to load that up on Egyptian ships and then ship that to Europe. That will not fly with Russia. Russia has already made it very clear this is going to happen. Now, there is so much more that we could say. There's so many layers to this that we could talk about. And what hurts me the most in trying to condense all this is not applying all the scriptural passages that we could be going into to show where this all ties in. And so from that aspect, I apologize. We're trying to take probably a lot more classes and condense them into the four and just give a very broad view of what we see happening. So if I've not mentioned something that you're thinking, man, you should have said this or should have commented on this, I do apologize for that, because it hurts to go by some of these things and just fly over them. There's so much to talk about. What we do want to change our focus before we close this class is how this affects all of us in these times. We have no hesitation by saying that we are living in Sodom and Gomorrah. If brethren 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago thought things were bad, they couldn't imagine. They couldn't imagine what we're seeing now. I don't think they could put their head around it. I can't put my head around it. The horrendous moral evils we see around us are really too much to comprehend at times. The Apostle Paul warned Timothy in 2 Timothy 3:1, "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. Men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection." We're seeing that today. "Truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof, from such turn away." Evil is not a new phenomenon. Paul was warning Timothy and the early Ecclesians of these characteristics that would challenge them in the last days of the Jewish Commonwealth. But they also very much apply to the end times we find ourselves in, if not more so. The aggressive and militant push that we see, especially on the gay pride, transgender front, goes beyond what the most evil societies in history encountered or embraced. Not being able to define what a woman is, that men can have babies, allowing or forcing little children into gender reassignment treatments and surgery, the celebration of abortion, forcing sexual deviancy on the children in schools. All of this is nauseating and abhorrent beyond measure. And we can never, ever, ever let ourselves become numb to it. That's the easier route in order to try to deal with it, but we can't become numb to it. And what's most interesting to us is that it is all done in the banner of pride. What does God say about pride? They celebrate pride. And I think that's interesting when we consider to what degree Yahweh views this fleshly characteristic as an utter abomination. Should we be surprised that the U.S. and the Western world is crumbling? Should we be surprised that we face economic ruin, disease, famine? These things are not simply happening. We are being forced to accept them. These people do not desire the welfare of man. Their whole intent and purpose in life is the total conformity of the populaces to unfettered hedonism. That is their goal. The total conformity of the populace to unfettered hedonism. And it is all being approved, endorsed, promoted, and legally forced upon the general populace by government authority. So what are we to do? I always come back to this statement of Christ. Be wise as serpents and harmless as what? As doves. We find ourselves in a very, very difficult situation. On one hand is a growing totalitarian type mindset that is seizing the reins of power both politically, socially, and morally. And on the other hand is a fiercely conservative, in some ways patriotic, fervor and desperation of resistance, desiring to hold on to the America that was, or the West that was. As strangers and pilgrims, and just as in the American Civil War of the 1860s, believers are stuck in the middle of two competing and incompatible worldviews, neither of which are compatible with God's ultimate plan and purpose. Now, there is no doubt that the present shift of power does not bode well for the religious tolerance and the relative peace and economic comfort that we as believers have benefited from for some time. If we think that recent events are just the normal ebb and flow of U.S. and world politics, and that things will balance out for life to continue in the manner in which we have grown accustomed, then we are sadly and naively mistaken. The question is, do we truly understand or comprehend this? With that said, we cannot fight for the past of a nation or culture in which we have been spiritual foreigners. Neither can we embrace the godless insanity now attempting the forced transformation of all aspects of our lives. If God's kingdom was of this world, then we would fight. We must resist their influence in the spiritual warfare of our minds and affections, but we cannot fight. Our time to fight will come with the advent of the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Please turn to Psalm 149. We've been there before, but we'll go there again. Psalm 149. Verse 5, let the saints be joyful in glory. Let them sing aloud upon their beds. Let the high praises of God or ale be in their mouth, and the two-edged sword in their hand, to execute vengeance upon the heathen and punishments upon the people, to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron, to execute upon them the judgment written, dishonor have all his saints. Praise ye Yahweh, the God. We wait. For now, it is as if we have become prisoners in an insane asylum. In the midst of this growing trial, there is an opportunity for us. The spiritually Laodicean mindset that has been mentioned several times this week, that has come to characterize the household in these modern times, has been brought about by the unprecedented comforts, security, and prosperity we have enjoyed. As Jeshurun, which has also been mentioned, the ideal Israel waxed fat and spiritually failed, as recorded in Deuteronomy 32 and 15, so too have we, collectively speaking. We have failed. If properly exercised thereby, as Paul, the Apostle Paul, exhorts us in Hebrews 12 and 11 regarding our trials, if properly exercised thereby, we can be spiritually strengthened in ways that times of peace and comfort only work to weaken us. History teaches us that the truth, as manifested through its believers, can only really thrive during trying times of trial. We have come through and continue to experience trials and strains within the body that have tested our fortitude for the last several years. But the trials we potentially face from without provide a new dimension that as modern day believers we have grown unaccustomed. God has promised to save us out of trials. He has not promised to save us from trial. Matter of fact, He has promised that we will be tried. We earnestly pray that our Heavenly Father will in fact shield us all from the coming storms while we await the return of our Master. But if anything, we should pray for the strength to weather the grievous evils that we see unfolding all around us. While those of the world vainly clamor for control over the lives and very minds of men, we stand in a most privileged position in regard to the one hope that we embrace. The vain ambitions of men of this world can have their day now. Let them have it. Enjoy it while they can. If you want to have a parade and flaunt yourself in the streets with a banner that says pride, go for it. But there is a day coming. As Daniel tells us in chapter 7, verse 27, the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, kingdom of the age, actually, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. With that said, watching the signs of the times is not enough. We must also keep our garments clean. Watching the signs of the times is not enough. Remembering that the whole purpose of all that is for Yahweh's glory to fill the earth as the waters cover the sea. This is his purpose. So we'll end with this quote from Brother Thomas. He says, "The blessing is not simply to him that watcheth, but to him that watcheth and keepeth his garments. Simply to believe that the Lord is near and to be able to discern the signs of the times will not entitle a man to the blessing. He must buy gold tried in the fire and white raiment that he may be clothed, and that the shame of his nakedness do not appear, and anoint his eyes with the eye salve that he may see. That eye salve that we as laid sins need desperately. In other words, he must believe the things concerning the kingdom of God in the name of Jesus Christ. Follow the example of the Samaritans and be baptized in the name of the Holy Ones, and thenceforth perfect his faith by his works as Abraham did. He will then be a lamp, well oiled and trimmed, and fit to shine forth as a glorious light as the marriage of the Lamb. A community of such persons in a city constitutes the Lamb's wife there, prepared for the coming of the Lord. He is arrayed in fine linen, clean and white, for the fine linen represents the righteousness of the saints, who have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore they will be before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple or kingdom, and he that sitteth upon the throne shall dwell among them. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither shall the sun light on them nor any heat. For the Lamb, which is in the midst of the throne, shall feed them, and shall lead them unto living fountains of waters, and God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes." Again, current events are interesting. The signs of our times we must discern, but we must make sure that we have our own spiritual houses in order. I really appreciate your attention and comments this week. Thank you very much.